Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, along with Jason Henricks this week. Ron Shevlin joins us once again. He is senior contributor to Forbes, director of research for Cornerstone Advisors, and a regular contributor and purveyor of fine snark for Breaking Banks and Provoke.fm. We are already over a month into 2020, but we're still looking ahead into the new year and the new decade. Ron is going to talk about his latest piece on Forbes.com, the five hottest technologies in banking for 2020. And Jason, you wrote a piece recently on the FinTech Forge blog called Welcome to 2020, Sailing into the Storm, where you talk about the changing landscape and financial services that leaders need to navigate.
Yeah, well, you know, that piece, for those who read my poor attempts at writing, is one of the longer form things I've done in a while. And largely because I ended up on a Ron Shevlin-esque snarky rant that, you know, bleeding into the holidays, I realized I was really sick of responding to, you know, give us your predictions for 2020 and give us your greatest hits of what happened in 2019. And then was doing an interview that kind of pushed me over the edge where it was talking about the future of financial services and how it's all going to change. And I won't say who the interviewer was, but, you know, kind of pushed back hard on it. It's like, yeah, but they've been saying banking's, you know, totally going to change for, you know, over a decade now. Nothing's really changed. You know, even Bitcoin, you know, has gone away and is dying now. And it really got me thinking about, you know, there's this fallacy that just because something hasn't changed so far, at least in line with the level of expectations we had for it, that therefore it means nothing is going to change. And so in the piece, what I tried to unpack is this idea that, you know, the fundamentals of the landscape have, you know, really already shifted. It's just we haven't seen in full maturity what the implications of that are going to be. And I think, you know, part of Ron, what I found interesting, your latest piece on kind of the top five priorities, you know, within banks, you hint at something similar, because as I looked at those priorities, part of them are banks playing catch up to a landscape that's already changed. And then your last two actually are pointed towards, you know, for many banks, you know, it's flat out, you know, fundamental heresy in how they think about they can operate it and how the future is going to look.
Yeah, you know, one of my oft twisted quotes of William Gibson, as he said about the future, is that disruption's already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. And I think both of you kind of hit at that. And Ron, the way you teed this up, your observations from the FinTech Snark Tank, is you quoted all the president's men, the idea of follow the money. And that's really what you've done, is you're looking at not what are people talking about, where are banks spending the money. So talk about your piece and what you came up with.
Yeah, so this is something that I've been doing as part of Cornerstone Advisors for, I guess, 5, maybe even 6 years now. I'm not even sure how far back, but every year, towards the end of the year, we'll survey financial institutions about their technology plans for the coming year, their challenges, how optimistic and pessimistic the CEOs are. And we've asked about 40, the list is close to about 50 different technologies. And it's not just the hot technologies like AI and blockchain and whatever. It's asking about everything, right down to, you know, core applications and networking systems and things like that. And basically what I'm asking them is, what are you going to select new or replacement systems for? What are you going to modify and enhance? Or what are you going to leave alone and do nothing? In other words, where are you putting your money in the coming year? And for the third straight year, Jason kind of alluded to three technologies that the banks have been putting their money in for a while and catching up. And those three technologies are digital account opening, P2P payments, and video collaboration or marketing systems. And the ones that were kind of the further out that they changed the game were the cloud computing and APIs. And so, to a large extent, Jason's spot on the digital account opening. You know, Chris Skinner the other day tweeted a link to the article I had written and said, this looks like, you know, a list from 2015. And I said, well, that's really not so bad when you consider that most banks are, you know, thinking that they're in the year 2016 as it is. And I think it was Sam Moll who responded, wait, I thought they were in 2006. So, yeah, there's to a large extent a lot of catching up that's being done. I don't think so much on the P2P payment side because they've had things in place there for a long time. But that's changing, I think, predominantly because the old paradigm of P2P payments being buried in seven layers deep into your online banking platform obviously is not the way it works. And so this is, you know, on the top of the list or towards the top of the list these days, all because of Zelle. That's really what's driving it. Zelle has really become ubiquitous or on its way to becoming ubiquitous. And a lot of mid-sized institutions are, you know, looking at what they've got and realizing they're going to have to jump on the bandwagon. And the third one, the video collaboration and marketing, you know, that really surprised me. That had not been on the list before. Put it on the list this year, and it jumped right into the top five technologies that banks were, and credit unions, both of them are incorporated in the survey. Was among the top five that were in the list for new selection and replacement. And my theory on that is that that has a lot to do with the fact that I think banks are finally getting serious about branch transformation, or if not serious about it, that's where they're putting their money, and they're seeing video as a key technology in the branches in particular. We can talk about cloud and APIs in a minute or two, but we'd love to get your guys' take on whether or not what you think about those three technologies, and if you think that the video was driven by the branches, or I think it's maybe something else.
Well, that was the one that was most surprising to me on that list, and I'd like to drill down a little bit more on how you think that the financial executives responded to that, how they're using video. Jason, what did you think when you saw that on Ron's list?
Well, yeah, my first reaction was, you know, one of shock and dismay. Not that I think Ron got this wrong, but if this is the top set of priorities that most of these banks in a pretty robust panel and well-conducted research think they're investments that are going to keep them competitive, like, they're just sadly mistaken that, you know, these are table stakes. The first three are the things that if you aren't actively doing this today, the pack is leaving you. You know, like, to use a road racing example, like, not only are you not breaking away, you're not in the peloton right now, folks. Like, you're pumping up your tires still if you are not actually actively fixing your digital account opening right now. And if you haven't already started thinking about, you know, this idea of video collaboration, like, I was also shocked that people were even saying it, because too often the platitude we hear is people love coming into the branch to talk to us. Like, no one wants to come into the branch to talk to you. Maybe not never, but it's oftentimes not very convenient. So this idea of actually meeting the customer where they are with something as 2008 as video collaboration that's become so mainstream, if that's your cutting edge innovation and where you're investing to remain competitive, you're not going to keep up. And I worry that with Ron's list, that too many banks are going to say, well, we're in pretty good shape because, you know, we're already, you know, going to do one this year. We're talking to Zelle, you know, that'll come up next. And, you know, we're going to figure out video collaboration. We don't have to worry about cloud and API. You know, we're doing 3 of 5, you know, that's a passing grade. No, it's not a passing grade. That if you're only doing those first three, you're, you know, barely able to keep the boat from taking on so much water you don't sink overnight, but you're still taking on water. If you're not getting to 4 and 5 and even things further into that stack, you're going to be in trouble.
Well, on the video piece, one of the things I was wondering is if people thought, is this a acceptable way to ease our way into digital delivery? You know, the folks love coming into the branch. They love our people. Maybe next step is we'll just put them on a video screen before we actually move this into the app. Ron, do you think that's what people were thinking when they responded to this?
Okay, couple of comments. first, you know, listen, as a guy who has a wife and three daughters knows very well, because everything I do and say is wrong in the house. This time you can't tell me I'm wrong about something on the list. I am just reporting the survey results. So I'm not
I'm not saying you're wrong, Ron. My daughter, even the dog, tells me I'm wrong. But yes.
You said Ron got this wrong. I'm just clarifying that. I didn't get this wrong.
No. He said, I'm not saying Ron got this wrong. Right. But it is surprising to both of us. And I think you said the same. It was a little surprising to you. I'm just trying to reverse engineer it a little bit. What causes a bank executive to say, well, you know what? 2020 is the year we're going to finally go to video.
I think I did not drive down into the whys of all the specific things, which is why I kind of put that out to you guys, what you're hearing and seeing. My hypothesis is that, you know, they are looking at re-engineering, reinventing the branches and looking to put video in there as a technology to handle the staffing challenges and the talent issues that they've got in terms of having to downsize the size of branches while maintaining value and things like that. So that was sort of my hypothesis on why the video collaboration tools were so high on the list. Now, you know, if you'd asked, we'd had this discussion a week ago, and Jason, you said, nobody wants to go in the branches. You know, I would have said, well, hold on. It's not quite nobody. You know, there's an age component to this for sure. But I have to tell you guys that I am in the middle of conducting a consumer survey. And in fact, more than just the middle. I've got about 2,200 responses out of the 2,500 that I'm shooting for. And there were two questions in the survey that I put in there. And one was, if you were in the market for a new checking account, credit card, or investment account, and you had a question about the alternatives, how would you prefer to interact with the provider? And I asked the respondents to rank face-to-face, phone, online chat, and email. And face-to-face is ranked number one with a pretty good distance over phone and online chat and email. Now, my theory was that, yeah, when it comes to, you know, new accounts, things like that, people are going to want to deal with their providers more in a face-to-face. But when it came to just issues and problems and things like that, so the follow-up question was, if you had a question or issue with an existing account, how would you prefer to interact with providers? And face-to-face, and it actually says face-to-face, that is, in the branch or their office, was still ranked number one, but just only slightly higher than phone. And so I was just kind of surprised that, wow, I did not expect face-to-face to come up. Now, I'm sure that there's probably going to be some demographic differences when I dive into that. But given that I've got 2,200 out of 2,500 responses already, it's the likelihood of those rankings changing at this point are pretty slim. So, you know, I think people do want the face-to-face, but I think the key there is that they're saying they want this because they can't get their problems or questions answered through other mechanisms as effectively as they can when they're actually talking to somebody.
Well, Ron, I think that is absolutely spot on, though, and you're the one who always is asking, you know, the why behind the why around this, and it raises the question, is it because people want to go open that account face-to-face, or making the decision and getting it open digitally is so painful that, of course, they want to go resolve it by going face-to-face because it's the only way to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it is. So I think that you know, the video aspect of it is a way that the banks think that they can provide that human interaction. But, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. This was at Finovate a couple years ago. I'll never forget this one. John Walsh from Kasasa was on a panel, and one of his fellow panelists was talking about interactive teller machines and how they were deploying them through a lot of their branches. And John turns to the guy and says, so let me get this straight. You were making your customers get up out of their couches, get into their cars, and drive down to their branches in order to interact with you when they have that technology in their homes. Why in the world would you be doing that? And the other panelist said, because we like to give our customers choices. And that was a pretty funny one. But I think that, and I was expecting you guys to laugh at least a little bit on that one. Okay.
All right. There's your laugh. That was funny.
Okay.
And I was trying to think of a good rejoinder to that one because we could give them a lot of other painful choices.
But I think that that's, you know, kind of the indication of the mentality behind a lot of the banks is that, you know, they're looking for ways of, they still are stuck to the belief that, you know, people want that human interaction, and, you know, finding that the video is a way of providing that in a more economical, effective manner.
Well, I do think that JP hit part of this, though, that I think that they're using the face-to-face interaction delivered, you know, via video and or chat is a way to be the salve over their actual digital shortcomings, because, you know, what can the human do or should be able to do is be adaptive to the customer's questions and make up for what otherwise might be a bad user experience by making it a more human experience. But if you actually, and this is what I think a lot of the challenger banks have done a good job at in their account opening, is actually stripping out, you know, one, by streamlining what they offer, you don't end up in the paralysis that most customers do of, I don't understand which account I'm supposed to be getting. You know, I recently was opening a new small business account for the Provoke and Breaking Banks. And for those who follow us on Twitter, probably saw my rantings on this. It was like nearly impossible. And I was driven to the branch because I couldn't understand even the difference between, you know, what is a premium plus versus a plus premium account. Like, how are these two things different? And they're like, well, one of them is if you do 500 transactions per month, but also don't go into the branch more than five times, but you only do cash management. And the other one is if you only do cash, and they're the, you know, I don't understand. So which one should I do? It's like, well, you need to decide, sir. And it's like, well, then how do I go about opening it? And I'm thinking to myself this whole time that this is a horrible customer experience and a horrible user experience, that even if you were, I guess I would have been happier had they delivered it via chat or, not via chat, that would have actually taken too much typing, but via video, because then I wouldn't be sitting in the branch being frustrated. I could have been doing something more useful, like, you know, petting my golden retriever at the same time to keep me from being stressed, with the fact that we're still within banking stuck in our own little world on this is the way it has to be.
Okay, but you're bringing up, I think, a really a much bigger point, Jason, which is around the process design. And I think what you're really saying is that a lot of these banks are creating Band-Aids by throwing people at the problem versus really fixing the process problem or design in the first place. You know, did a report a while back on the common mistakes that a lot of banks make in digital account opening. You know, and one of them is that they take their offline process and just sort of try to digitize it. So number one, they're asking about a lot of fields and a lot of questions that they don't really need to ask just to get the account open. So it takes too long, and that really turns people off. You know, a second issue, and I think this is an important one, is that it doesn't reflect how people are actually shopping and selecting the product in the first place. You know, I don't think what you were really doing when you were looking for the account was picking, okay, let me first pick my provider and then I'll choose the best account from that provider. You were basically going, let me find the best product I need and the best account. And then what happens is, and this happens way too often with a lot of banks' digital account opening processes, is that you get in there and then they're like, oh, okay, so you want the, you know, the Supreme account. Well, did you know we have this bundle where if you bundle the Supreme with the other, and then all of a sudden you start confusing. And you're not, they don't recognize the fact that, look, somebody's made their decision already. You know, if you're going through bundles and pricing things and relationship type pricing things, put that out there during the selection process. So when somebody gets to the actual application process, it's a done deal and there are no questions. But what happened to you as part of this process was they threw a, you know, a wrench in there, and you had a question about it, and they could not be answered in the context of that digital account opening process. So I think that's what's going on with a lot of the account opening processes in particular. So it's interesting that while, you know, digital account opening is number one on the on our list of priorities for the year, it's and they're playing catch up. The reality is that they may get themselves into more problems because of poor design in the implementation than they are going to see a lot of benefit from having just thrown these technologies at the problem.
So it's interesting. You hit one of the things, one of my major theses on what's changed in the implications from this blog post is this idea of product-led versus an affinity towards this is my provider, what products do they have available, right? And so it wasn't about that, you know, looked like a plastic Denny's menu that this banker, you know, slid across the table to me and asking, you know, do I want this bundle or that bundle? To your point, had already been making the decision. I just had, you know, but it was product-led. It was not provider-led. And I think that speaks to one of the other major changes that we see in the environment now, that the real ramifications are yet to be seen, that consumers are actually perfectly happy now to have a whole host of providers, you know, maybe not a one-to-one relationship of however many different products I have to different providers I have. There might be some overlap, but for the most part, I'm going to pick the best product for me. And if a bank or a financial service provider, a tech company actually solves the digital account opening issue that takes the friction out of it for me, I'm happy to, you know, continue to multiply and grow that host of relationships in a linear fashion. But I think, you know, Ron, one of your most important points here is if you're only putting that, you know, digital lipstick on the analog pig of what your existing process is, you're going to end up with something that's actually worse than where you started. And how many of the banks, I don't know if there was any free form in the survey, when they talked about their digital account opening initiative, are they actually going to level, are they just looking for a new vendor? Are they thinking of a new process? Are they thinking of a new experience?
I couldn't answer that from the survey. Did not get into that level of detail. But I think just anecdotally from especially the report that we had done a couple months ago, I think it's a minority who really think of it from the experience perspective. Clearly, I think at this point, you know, we've reached a point where there's an increasing number of institutions who are actually replacing existing digital account opening systems versus selecting new at this point. So there's clearly some dissatisfaction with the existing packages or systems that they've got, or perhaps the vendors altogether. So we're definitely at that point. But I couldn't tell you how many, from a quantitative perspective, how many are looking for experience versus doing process.
On the banks that are, you know, coming out of that report and beginning to rethink about this, do you have any sense of what the, you know, key gap is? Like, what would your hypothesis be where they fall down when they're approaching solving their digital account opening experience?
I think the number one challenge or problem that they've got is their approach or philosophy, whatever, towards compliance and risk management. You know, I think that they want to build in all of the compliance and risk management factors into the process so that it's done. And then you've got the problem of the trade-off where you're asking, you know, more questions than you need to. It takes more time. You then start getting a lot of abandonment issues. And I think that if they would rethink this and say, let's just take the minimum number, let's just get the minimum level of information we need to get the account open, get it open and funded, and then apply the risk management and compliance steps that we need to take after the fact, that you know, they'd find themselves opening a lot more accounts digitally than they are today.
JP, what would you hazard to guess? You know, we talk to a lot of banks about this. Where do you think they're falling down?
Well, I agree with that. I was just going to say, Ron's clearly been listening in on a lot of conversations that we've been having with banks. And I largely agree that we have this process that was built for brick and mortar, pen and paper. And now we just try to shoehorn that into an app or a few lines of code. And those that have really created a better experience have kind of started fresh and thought about, look, let's get, yes, we're going to be compliant, but let's get the account open and we can solve a lot of the stuff on the back end. We don't have to walk the customer through all of these steps.
I think walking it through, I wouldn't disagree with anything either one of you had said. The thing I might add to that, though, is I think a lot of times we miss the fact that opening a new account or getting a new product is actually part of a very different journey when we take the customer's perspective. I don't know anyone who wakes up in the morning and says, you know what I need today is, a new checking account. No, I need a new checking account because for whatever reason, our banks like to send us checks and I can't actually get over the RDC limits with one of our banks. So I need a physical location that I can go deposit checks, but that's because I moved. Or I got married, or we had kids, or the kids have left the house. You know, in Ron's case, is you guys are thinking about, the inevitable empty nest land. Are you going to stay where you are? Are you going to buy the place in Arizona because New England winters are too much for you? You know, it's part of a broader journey. No one actually has this very discrete, I need this financial service product. And as a result, if we're only thinking about it from the perspective of what does that account require, or what does that product require, we miss the fact, why is Rocket Mortgage, even though it's more expensive than what you'd get at a local branch bank, it's more expensive, but people do it. Why? Because I'm not waking up to buy a mortgage. I'm getting a new house. And guess when I need to figure out the financing is Saturday after we are at an open house and my branch isn't open. And I think that's where I see one of the big places they fall down.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Well, and I think a lot of those things carry over to number two on Ron's list, and that was person-to-person or P2P payments. So, Ron, talk about what you find in your survey. And then, Jason, I know you've spent a lot of time on this as well. I'm curious for the two of you to compare notes.
Yeah, this is the second year in a row that adding new or replacing the existing P2P vendors is in the top five. In fact, I think it was number two last year as well. So, clearly there's a lot of interest and demand on part of the banks and credit unions to start looking for some new P2P provider. But, this is, I think, as I alluded to earlier, I think this is in reaction to a couple of things and trends in the marketplace. Number one, they've mostly had some sort of P2P capability, Pop Money or something like that, that's been integrated into their online banking platform for a long time and is doing nothing for them and has done nothing for them. And now they're kind of, responding to the Zelle adoption. I think it was something like 22 out of the top 25 banks, largest banks, are already Zelle users, with a couple more planning to come on. Among the next 45 largest, I think half of them were already Zelle users, or Zelle providers, I should say. And so, there's, I think, practically every mid-sized financial institution that's out there, or maybe not every one, but a huge percentage of them, are wrestling with, do we go with Zelle or not? And if we don't, what are our alternatives in doing so? And I think they're getting to the point where it's coming down to, a non-choice, where in terms of the need to be tightly integrated and to have that ubiquity and to fight off the potential threats from a Venmo or Apple or even Facebook P2P solution, that the banks kind of have to band together as an industry to do that. I think, you know, as I hear from a lot of mid-sized institutions, they're not happy with that, given the financial arrangements that they have to get themselves into, as well as providing data. There's some question as to, I've heard rumors that when you sign up with Zelle, you're asked to provide your entire customer list, whether they're mobile banking customers or not, because someday they might be. So you've got to provide that, which is, you know, almost like turning over your customer list to the competitors for all intents and purposes. But you know, I think a lot of banks are just between a rock and a hard place when it comes to P2P payment, especially when you consider that they're not charging for this, so there's no revenue stream to this. This is simply becoming a, you know, cost of doing business. You've got to do it, but it's a competitive threat issue, because even I've pointed to some of the research I've done that says consumers who are happy with Venmo would consider Venmo as a debit card, general debit card provider, and there's a real threat there. So. That's, I think, what's driving the P2P interest.
You know, and I think, you know, part of this also harkens back to, we need to think about the world from the eyes of our customers. You know, if you really want to look at when Venmo was being started, there shouldn't have been a market there. You know, it's there's lots of ways I can pay people. I can, you know, write them a check. I can go to the ATM. I can get them cash. I can send them a bill pay. Yet Venmo had this explosive growth because they were thinking about it from the eyes of the customer, which is, there's this weird upside down relationship. As everything was going digital, it turns out we still actually go to physical places with people we know, and we need to settle up with them. And so our physical social life, you know, continues to expand, but our digital financial life hasn't caught up. And it makes me wonder what that next iteration of that's going to be, because I think we're just, you know, there at the turning point of, you know, is peer-to-peer from a payments perspective eventually going to be conducted without going through central clearing institutions? Now, as you know, I'm not one who's going to say, oh, you know, crypto is going to take over the world and decentralization, you know, is everything. But I do think if the players within the value chain aren't thinking about what value they provide at each step of the transaction, that's just ripe for disruption.
Yeah. Oh, and I certainly agree that we need more focus on it from the customer's perspective, but let's do consider the bank's perspective for a minute. They are getting eaten alive by the Venmos and Square Cashes and competitors of the world. And at the same time, the alternative to go to Zelle has maybe not so attractive to a lot of the community or mid-sized banks. So, I mean, what are the issues from the bank's perspective, Jason?
Well, I think Ron hit one of the, you know, challenges in terms of what is the use case, you know, because they can't charge for it. And this has, you know, the dilemma of, you know, is one of the banks we work with calls it ATM 2.0. where, you know, the big banks made sure there was an ATM on every corner, and in the early days, you know, only charged 50 cents a transaction to smaller banks to use that network. But suddenly it became $3.50 to do that, plus the, you know, for an ATM fee that, you know, if you use one of the other banks, you're getting charged. And suddenly it became really expensive. So people said, well, I'm going to go to that larger institution, then I get free ATMs. And, you know, it makes you wonder if in the peer-to-peer world, if that isn't, you know, the way it's going to play out. And, you know, one of the challenges here being, you know, Early Warning, which is the backer of Zelle, is owned by the biggest banks. And so that does, you know, raise the question, if it's not, you know, quite to the level as Ron described, of giving, you know, someone your customer list and, you know, it's going to be taken advantage of, you know, what is the long term, as just to keep up and to stay on par is becoming more and more expensive, And at the same time, you're seeing your customers have relationships with more and more institutions, not just, you know, a single institution that I can average that expense over. You know, it does begin to make it a very big quandary for strategically where a community bank is going to pick, where they're going to play and how they're going to win.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, maybe let's talk about the latter couple of things on your list, Ron, cloud computing and APIs, and they're separate, but perhaps related in some ways. And if there's anything we've been talking about for a long time on this show and around the industry, it's certainly cloud computing and APIs. Neither are new technologies, but as you say, organizations are starting to talk about them more. What did you find in your research?
So this is another case where, relatively new entry into the list on the service. So I don't have years to go back, and I wish I did, because there's a lot of perceptions that as an industry, banks are behind the rest of the world on cloud computing. I don't know if that's the case or not. But a quarter of the institutions that I surveyed said that they plan to invest in or implement cloud computing technologies in 2020. And that's on top of 40% who said that they've already done so. And of those 40%, half said that they're going to enhance or modify what they've got. All that said, although I could not quantify the percentage of banks and credit unions who are still anti or proponents of cloud computing, I know anecdotally there are still, because I've did another piece of research last year on cloud computing and had a number of interviews with some CEOs and CIOs who were just adamant about not moving to a cloud environment. And what I find kind of funny or surprising about that is that, you know, there are many who actually work with vendors whose tools and technologies are in the cloud, and the bank or credit union doesn't even know that. So basically, you know, they're not even aware that they have, you know, they're using vendors' tools and technologies who are already in the cloud. That said, I came to the conclusion that this is an inevitable journey to the cloud for banks for a couple of reasons. One being AI adoption. You know, the ability to utilize and get value out of AI tools and technologies, machine learning in particular, is all about data. And most institutions just simply do not have enough high enough quantity or quality of data to really drive AI solutions, which means they're going to have to enhance it with third-party data sources, whether that's aggregated data from across institutions or different types of data from various types of vendors. But the only way they're going to effectively be able to do that is if they're in a cloud environment. There's just simply no way to do that. I think also that sort of the changes in what's happening from an analytics perspective, and I think this might be also very related to the other side of the coin from machine learning, but just the way analytic tools are going to be delivered more as a service by open platforms, and I think that's where Salesforce is going in their direction with the acquisitions they've made, as well as some other providers. And so this is, to me, an inevitable journey to the cloud for many institutions. And I think this is the first year that the numbers are really starting to prove that out.
Now, I'm curious, Ron, can you put more color around why there was a throwing up of arms around, oh my gosh, we could never go to the cloud, when we've seen some of the biggest banks have fully embraced cloud? And if you're working with any kind of, you know, modern software company, they almost certainly are in the cloud. You know, Salesforce in what they're doing in the cloud, Finastra, what they're doing in the cloud. You know, to do modern things, you're going to have to touch cloud. You know, where does this reticence come from?
Yeah, the number one reticence was clearly around data security issues, and the misconception that, you know, somehow you're putting your customers or your members' data up in the cloud. Like it was this mysterious thing, we're just going to throw this data up in the air and it's just going to kind of float there. And, you know, if we're not careful, somebody's going to come along and grab it. Now, I'm making fun of it, and I really shouldn't be, because, look, This is the belief on the part of a lot of executives. And what I found is that, look, you don't counter or change people's beliefs with data. You know, and I don't mean customer data. I mean with numbers.
Yeah.
You don't change people's opinions. Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize for behavioral economics, said that you don't change people's minds with numbers. You change their minds with stories. You know, and that's the problem that cloud computing has had until recently, is that, you know, they're trying to counter the misconceptions about data security in the cloud with theory instead of practical, you know, uses and stories. And unfortunately, there are stories that work against it, like what happened to Capital One last year in AWS. So, you know, sometimes the stories don't help. But so you've got this minority of both CIOs and CEOs. In some institutions, it's the CEO who's got that perception, and in many others, it's the CIO who's got this perception that, you know, there is just inferior data security in the cloud versus otherwise. And I think what's happening is that there's a lot of financial institutions beginning to realize and recognize that with the amount of resources that a Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and if you guys want to get into it, whether or not a Goldman Sachs, and this was the story today, whether Goldman Sachs was going to get into the cloud provisioning business as well. But reality is even if they were to, those four companies can bring a hell of a lot more resources to the table to build, deploy, and service data security than a mid-sized financial institution's ever going to be able to. And so I think this is what's, you know, kind of helping to drive the change, but I think it's also what's helping to lock a bunch of institutions into their misconceptions about data security.
You know, funny side story on that, Ron. When we launched Perk Street, we were running all of our non-banking, but still held a lot of customer data in it around how we ran our rewards program, where we gave cash back in the form of merchant rewards, because as you and I were talking about on Twitter this week, you know, that was a way we could actually give more than just standard interest, and it had real tangible value to the customers. But we were running it on Amazon Web Services. You know, AWS as an acronym was not so popular then, and we were meeting with a regulator and one of our partner banks, and the regulator looked at me, you know, just with these wide eyes, and she goes, "You mean your data is where I buy my shoes?" And all I could think to myself, you know, and then we ended up on this whole on-prem versus off-prem, and I could only think to myself, I'm like, at this point, we're a 27-person startup, and I'm like, you think I can do data security better than those people can who hire, like, the best and the brightest and have, like, all sorts of PhDs? And you think just because I can look at it in a data server, you know, that's in a locked cabinet? I mean, not that our cabinet was not very secure. I helped install it myself, mind you. But like the physical location made no difference to the true security of the data.
Yep. Like, you're spot on. The regulatory perceptions. But I think that's changing. You know, I definitely think that's changing. But there, I think you still get the diehards who are just not willing to change their philosophical approach to this.
Well, Ron, one of the things you cited in this move to cloud becoming more of a reality for more financial institutions this year is AI and then analytics. But, you know, later in your article, you also talk about, despite all of the hype, you list a couple of things: RPA, chatbots, machine learning, and blockchain. But let's take machine learning and kind of couple that with AI for a moment. I was meeting with somebody doing actually kind of core banking services in the cloud earlier this week, and we were kind of laughing about, let's define what we mean by AI, because we're hearing a lot of people say, if they have a database, that seems like AI to them. And she said, "Oh yeah, we've heard a new one now, which is, we're AI inspired." I said, "Well, you know, I trot around on a soccer field on the weekends. I guess from now on, I'll say I'm Messi inspired." But, you know, if machine learning is way off in the future for the banks that you've talked to and their spending priorities, but we're going to go to the cloud and we're going to use AI. How do you reconcile all of those priorities?
I don't know how you reconcile those priorities, but here's what I think is happening, JP, is this is the difference between who I'm talking to and who maybe other writers and researchers are talking to or surveying when they do their research. My sample set is very much mid-sized financial institutions. The top 30 banks, the four mega banks and the next 25 or so are not included in my survey. So when I say that only 8% of the respondents to my survey have deployed machine learning and only 4% have deployed chatbots and only 7% have deployed robotics process automation, that sample set is representative or try to be representative of the thousands of institutions below $100 billion in assets. My guess is that, you go to the top 10 banks and you're going to see a lot more work around machine learning, chatbots, RPA in particular, because they've got the size of the budgets to do this. But the mid-sized on down are very heavily reliant on vendors, if not almost exclusively reliant on vendors for the vast majority of the applications and systems they provide. And so to go off and to develop something, some sort of machine learning solution, ultimately has to be integrated in to the vendor platform. And that's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. It's a lot of cost. And there better be a lot of return for it. Whereas the largest institutions can do some experimentation with these things. They can, B of A can roll out, what's the name, Erica. And I'm a B of A customer. I find it to be absolutely useless. So they're big enough to go deploy something that's useless and throw that kind of money in and take years for it to be honed and enhanced to something that provides some value if it ever does. But for mid-sized institutions, they just simply can't take that risk. And so we're seeing, and you're going to see for the next couple of years, this gradual assimilation of AI-related technologies like chatbots, like machine learning, like RPA, into the existing major applications and platforms that the banks and credit unions already use. And so, there's a lot of vendors that are out there. I talk to a lot of them on a day-to-day basis who are bringing some good approaches and technology and tools to the table from an AI perspective to do things like risk management and compliance, and in particular in the lending areas around credit modeling and credit decisioning and so forth. But as standalone tools and technologies, they're going to struggle because the budgets just aren't there for the mid-sized institutions. And, we're going to see this evolution where there'll be a lot more partnerships integration. We'll start to see that assimilation of the various AI-related technologies into the existing tools and systems and platforms.
Well, I agree with all of that, and I just think it's interesting. We've had so many really interesting guests on the show lately that are doing some pretty amazing things, and you look at what Brad and Jim Roos found when they were in China, and then this is kind of a real dose of reality for the vast majority of the institutions operating in the U.S. at least. And Jason, I'm going to give you the last word in a couple of minutes, because you wrote about this from the bank's perspective. What are they to do? But Ron, first, I'm just curious. The last thing on your list was APIs and all those things that you just said about the evolution and the timeline and all this. Do you think that applies to APIs too, or are there any kind of special cases that apply for bankers and APIs in 2020?
So a couple, to clarify a little bit about the API in the top five list here, remember how I went about compiling the list of the top five was asking them about, 50 different technologies and asking them what were they going to be investing in either from a addition, replacement, or enhancement perspective. But separately, there's a section, and this all comes from a report that I just published called What's Going On in Banking 2020, that looks at a much broader range of things like their optimism for the coming year, the priorities, objectives, things like that. And one of the areas that I asked a lot about was fintech partnerships. This was the second or third year in a row that I asked about that. And no surprise, I'm sure, to the listeners that there's a growing percentage of both banks and credit unions who are entering into fintech partnerships. Last year, it was about half of the credit unions, about 6 out of 10 credit unions and half of banks. And this year, it's about 3/4 of the credit unions and 2/3 of the banks. And so I think that's what's driving a lot of the API interest, JP, is that there's a lot more fintech partnership, collaboration, acquisition, perhaps, that's going on in the banking space, and that's driving a lot of this need for API deployment and development to enable that, because they can't hardwire a lot of that integration, and it has to come through APIs.
Oh, and like you said, that this is another area where the banks have to rely on their partners for that. Well, Jason, I mean, this hits into so many of the themes that you have been writing about and talking about lately. Let's wrap it up with, what is your advice to bank leaders as they go forward in 2020 and try to navigate not only the set of priorities in terms of technology, but the shifting landscape?
Well, I take a little bit of exception with they have to be reliant upon their cores. I think that's a convenient truth that, you know, the industry has been telling itself. I was on the phone today with head of innovation for a $500 million institution, and they decided enough was enough, and they built their own middleware layer that they can actually now, without having to integrate into the core, just flows through this middleware that they developed and own, integrate to anyone they want. I think that's where we need to get to. I think an important element of what Ron just said is that, you know, when we really tell ourselves, oh, you know, I can't do that, they would rather settle for something subpar because they don't want to risk it not working out a la Erica. And as a result, they never actually are going to succeed, right? You're not going to, you know, fail your way to success by always opting for the thing that doesn't work very well, but at least it didn't completely fail. And that gets to, you know, when you want to talk about what do banks need to be doing to address this, number one is fixing culturally this idea that everything is going to work as expected every single time, because your bar is probably too low if it's always going to work as expected every single time. You're not actually going to go do something interesting. You're going to look like the rest of the industry. And, you know, I think we're now seeing, you know, it isn't just that they have bigger budgets why you're seeing some banks succeed, not just the biggest banks. There's a number of small banks and credit unions that are doing a good job at this now. They're the ones that have culturally been able to get around their heads around this idea of we need to go do something new and it's not always going to work out. And, you know, in the article I described it as, you know, I was talking about this storm idea of, you know, you need to learn how to sail, and you don't learn to sail by standing on land. You have to get out on the water to start doing it. No one becomes a great sailor overnight. You know, I certainly capsized the first couple times I was out, well, probably much more than I should admit to for a long time. But you have to get out there and start doing it. And it's better to start sailing while the waters are calm, meaning before you are actually literally in the storm of the world is changing around you, and now you're going to go figure out how to use APIs, well, it's too late. I'd say the second piece that banks should be thinking about right now is they need to put a couple buoys out in the water. These are small bets on doing new things that no one of them is going to completely overturn how the bank works. But thinking about doing new things and doing some testing with new customers, new products, new partnerships, not just talking about them or waiting, they're going to inform the direction that they need to go in the longer term. And those are the two things that they can and should start doing today, because otherwise it's going to get really messy over the next decade.
Hey, JP, a couple reactions if I can.
Sure.
First of all, I hope we're recording this so that I can go back and prove to Jason that I never used the word core. I didn't say they had to rely on the core. I said they had to rely on their vendors. And that's not just the core vendors, because there can be, you know, digital banking platforms, lending platforms, other CRM and so forth that are probably integrated. I'm sure they're integrated to a large extent with the core, but I didn't say the core vendors.
So okay, that's fair
number
enough.
One. But the other aspect, I definitely totally agree with you on a lot of that. I might be inclined to argue that this isn't calm waters now. You know, that ship has sailed, to continue the nautical examples. You know, that kind of goes back to something you had said at the very beginning of this, around, you know, the folks who are saying that, you know, nothing has really changed. You know, a lot has changed. The problem is that when you're in the middle of any of it, and this is true in all of life, you know, I look at that picture on my dresser, my wife's in our bedroom from our wedding, and I look at that picture and go, God, have I changed? Man, do I look old now? But I don't see any of that on a day-to-day basis. And that's the problem that a lot of bankers have, is that they're so ensconced in the middle of the industry, they don't see a lot of these changes. But, you know, the percentage of consumers who in the U.S. who have, you know, fintech, neobank bank accounts is now up to 25%. You know, many of them are selecting these not because they're replacing their primary bank, but because they need ancillary or accessory accounts to do something. And so, you know, I think to answer JP's question about, you know, what can the banks and credit unions really be doing here? Here's my take, is I think we're getting to an environment where unless you're one of the top four or maybe one of the top 10 banks, anybody below that, you almost by necessity these days better be approaching the market with a niche-based strategy. To me, good examples of that would be USAA, who goes after the military market. You know, I love what Uber's doing, because they're basically, they don't care about the general consumer. Their focus with their financial services efforts are going to be Uber drivers. You know, the segment has to be big enough, or the niche has to be big enough to support a particular size institution, and that will differ, of course. But I think the focus, JP, for many of these institutions has got to be strategy clarification from the start. You know, the idea that you're going to succeed in this industry because you have superior service just doesn't cut it. You know, it's not quantifiable. It's not defensible. It's not even right anymore, especially when you see that so much of the service is moving from human delivered to either technology delivered or technology enabled. So I think that, you know, to get the IT and technology prioritization straight has got to start with better strategic clarification. I just don't think a lot of financial institutions have stepped up to the plate to realize that, you know, their core strategies from a business perspective aren't sustainable.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. I also like the sailing analogies. It reminds me of a show we had from last year that was entitled, "You Can't Change the Wind, But You Can Adjust Your Sails." And if you can listen to that show and all of our more than 300 episodes, plus our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on provoke.fm. If you like the show, give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. And that's it for this week. We will be back with more again next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.